You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
David Sedaris is a master of the personal essay. He's written about being a 33-year-old Santa's elf at Macy's, about his years growing up with his siblings in North Carolina, about quitting smoking, and about living abroad. He is a regular contributor to The New Yorker, This American Life, and BBC Radio 4, and his stories are funny, sharply observed, and often surprisingly moving. His latest book, his eighth, is Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. It's published by Little Brown, and it went straight to the top of the New York Times bestseller list when it was released, and that's just one of the reasons that I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi, David.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, you got to start off with the title. Where does Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls come from?
I was signing somebody's book one night, and sometimes people tell you exactly what they want you to sign, and usually it's kind of lame, to tell you the truth. And so I didn't want to write that. She wanted me to write Explore Your Possibilities and to her daughter, and I said, well, I'll keep the word explore. And then, I don't know, I just said, wrote Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought,
was she pleased?
No, because she wanted her message in there. But I thought I'm gonna make that a book title. I just am pretty pleased with it.
Well, you gave your boyfriend Hugh a stuffed owl for Valentine's Day one year, so owls are something you're really interested in. Can you talk about how hard they are to find? I would have thought stuffed owls would be pretty easy to find.
Not in the United States, they're protected, so you can't even if you find a dead owl. And on your doorstep, you can't have it stuffed. You can't even keep one of its feathers. That's how protected they are in the United States.
So what do you have to do? Give it a decent burial?
I guess, or just leave it alone or let an animal come and take it. But you can't put it in your freezer. I mean, they're super protected here. But in England, they're still protected, but not as much as they are here. So you find them a lot at flea markets, and usually they were stuffed during the Victorian era. But I bought Hugh a brand new one, stuffed owl, and so I wound up writing a story about it. I didn't buy it to write a story about it, but I went to the taxidermy shop, and a story just sort of unfolded in a really beautiful way. It just sort of presented itself to me.
Well, can you talk about the taxidermy shop and what else you saw in there?
There was a store in North London, and he also sold some human parts. So he had a pygmy skeleton in there, and
I don't think you can sell that in New York either.
I don't know. I mean, I've bought skeletons before.
You know, you say you have a skeleton, the kind that we had in our science classrooms in high school?
Yeah. I mean, it's a human skeleton. I bought it in France. But you see skeletons a lot, quite often, for sale in England, in skulls and stuff. But this was a pygmy skeleton. And pygmies, apparently, the English used to go to the Congo and hunt the pygmies for sport. And so this guy had a pygmy skeleton, and he had a human arm that his grandfather had mummified, and he had the head of a 14-year-old girl in a plastic bag.
Oy.
And I don't know if they were for sale or just his own things, but I tried to write about that right after it happened, and it didn't work out. And it wasn't until later that I realized the story to me was that the guy looked into my soul. You know how that happens sometimes? Somebody just looks into your soul and they just read you like that. And so that's what the story was really about, being clocked by this stranger. I think, like, the head and the plastic bag and the arm, they weren't out in the open. They were, you know, he had them in his special place. And he only showed them to certain people. But that I walked in and he knew immediately that I would be all over a head in a plastic bag.
He saw you as a kindred spirit. You also have a life-size model of a human throat?
Yeah. Hugh gave it to me for Valentine's Day one year. There's a
you have the most romantic Valentine's Days, owls and throats.
Well, he used to just give me cartons of cigarettes, but then I quit smoking, and so then it sort of opened up a bit.
You travel a lot. Are you the kind of person who likes to collect souvenirs?
I do. Like, I'm going to Italy this summer. I'm going for a literary festival. And the only reason I'm going to this literary festival is that I get to fly into the city of Turin. And there's a shop there called Nautilus. And it is one of the great medical curiosity stores in the world. And I went there a couple of years ago, and I just stumbled upon it, and I could not believe the fantastic stuff that this guy had. There was a dermatology museum in the Czech Republic that closed a couple of years ago, and they had all these wax models of just the most hideous things you can imagine. And the collection got dispersed throughout the world, and he has some choice pieces. And so I bought some things from him a couple of years ago.
So that's the only reason to go to Turin? You know, the food isn't bad in Italy.
Yeah, but I mean, what I'm really looking forward to is Nautilus.
The book includes a few of what you call forensics monologues. Where did that idea come from?
Over the years at book signings, I've met quite a few teenagers, and they participate in forensics, which didn't exist when I was young. But it's kind of a cross between speech club and debate. And kids take stories and essays, and then they cut them down to a length of 7 to 10 minutes, and they deliver them dramatically before judges. So I met kids who said, oh, I went to state finals with A Plague of Ticks or 6 to 8 Black Men. So they've taken essays that I wrote and memorized them and cut them down. And I hate the idea of like a 17-year-old cutting 1,500 words out of something I wrote. So I thought I'd write something that was 7 to 10 minutes long. So I wrote 3 for boys and 3 for girls. And since the book came out, I've been invited to be the judge at the National Forensic Competition next year in Kansas City.
So you don't deliver them yourself?
When I read out loud on the book tour or something, I'll read it out loud. But they were written for teenagers to memorize and deliver out loud.
And all of them are impassioned. A few are political commentaries. One is about a man who's so upset about states legalizing gay marriage that he kills his family and goes on a crime spree. Well, that sure stopped that movement, didn't it?
Well, I think what troubled me about teenagers memorizing my essays and such is that I don't feel like the voice in those essays is necessarily passionate. I love people who are just convinced of themselves. And even if I don't agree with them politically, I just love to hear from people because I can't imagine that. Like, I'm so full of self-doubt that I shoot myself in the foot. But people who are convinced that they're right, like even those Westboro Baptist church people, they have no doubt. And someone who has no doubt has my ear.
Well, actually, we recently had one of those people on our show. She had doubts, and they threw her out. You can't have doubts. I wonder if that's true of the Tea Party people as well. You have one about a Tea Party member gearing up for a rally.
It's a woman whose son has sort of completely set her up. And I absolutely love reading that story out loud, and I really like that character. She and I wouldn't agree. I mean, that sounds weird to talk about someone as if they exist, but she and I wouldn't agree on much, but I like her spirit.
My guest is David Sedaris. His latest book is Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, subtitled Essays, Etc. You've talked about keeping a diary for many decades. Have you written in a diary pretty much every day since you started doing that?
I started keeping a diary 35 years ago, and I bet I've missed, I don't know, maybe 60 days over 35 years.
Well, is it really like a diary or more like a writer's journal?
No, it's a diary. It's like a 16-year-old girl's diary, except I'm, 56. But it's not a journal. I mean, a journal to me is more, I mean, I wrote in the essay that a journal is your brain on the page, where a diary is more your heart, I think.
Well, a journal is writing down ideas, even if it's in a diary form, that you suspect you're going to want to go back to somewhere down the line and use for material. Are you using the diary that way?
Yeah, but I go through my diary and I'll find things and I'll think, oh, this might work. Or maybe I could, like when I went to buy the owl, I wrote about it all in my diary the next morning, but I didn't And I referred to it later when I was writing a story. But, I mean, there are many things that I write down that I'm pretty sure I'm never going to write a story about, but I write them down anyway just because, oh, I don't know. I mean, the fellow who picked me up at the airport yesterday is a member of the Al Jolson Society. And then he sang some Al Jolson songs, and I wasn't prepared for it. His voice was so, he had such a wonderful voice. And he's lived in the same house since he was 5 days old, and he's 60 now.
Do you find people open up to you because they know who you are?
No, I think most people will open up if you ask them, if you're genuinely interested in them. You know, if they feel like you're asking questions because you're just being patronizing, you know, everybody can sense that. But he was just such a lovely man, and one thing just kind of led to another and another. And I would just like to put him in my pocket and bring him everywhere with me.
Did he do a good Al Jolson? You do a great Billie Holiday. I'd imagine
he did do a very good Al Jolson.
He did a good one.
Yeah. And who knew that there was an Al Jolson Society?
At this late date.
Yeah, that's what I like about it.
Do you have a good memory? When you look at your diary, do you remember everything immediately, or do you find surprises there?
I tend to remember, like, if you were to say to me, oh, remember we went to that dinner party one time at that person's house? Then I'd say, really? We really went to that person's house? But if I write in my diary that I was taking a plane and that the person across the aisle from me, the flight attendant said, would you like anything to drink? And he said, I would appreciate a Bloody Mary. I'm right back to that day. Usually if it's just an observation, just kind of a banal observation, that brings me back to something more than a big event, really.
So do you write down things like conversations you overhear?
Oh, yeah. Well, because, you know, when you're alone, you tend to be more keyed into the conversations around you. That's why if I go to a restaurant and I'm with a friend and then there's a single person at the next table, I'm so much more self-conscious of what we're talking about because, you know, there's nothing else really for that person to do except listen to you. And the cell phone, you know, I mean, of course, changed that. But, I mean, the cell phone gave you, if anything, I think the cell phones made people stop tuning in to other people because, I listen to people all the time and they're talking about their job, calling somebody. And I think, I've been listening to you for 10 minutes and I have no idea what you do for a living. Like HR, IT, I don't know what those things mean.
But do you ever wonder why they're so willing to talk about really personal things loudly in a public place? Or in other cases, I've noticed more and more, a lot of people are very happy to carry on all of their conversations in the loudest voices on the bus, on the train, whereas in the past they might very well have just leaned over and talked a lot more quietly. It's as though they almost want the world to know all of these intimate things.
Do you think reality TV had something to do with that?
I have no theories. I'm asking you. You're the man who knows stuff.
I don't know. Gosh, I mean, I am often surprised. See, I'm the only one in the world without a phone, so I am often surprised at the things people will talk about on the phone. But I think that it just doesn't... I think maybe they're people who don't listen to other people, so they just assume that no one's listening to them. If you do listen to other people, then you're assuming that me anyway. Like I think if I'm having a conversation in an elevator with somebody and there's a single person over there, I'm thinking they're listening to this and they're thinking, God, that guy is so stupid.
You always think that people are judging you that way?
Yeah, I always judge
down.
See,
that guy's stupid?
I always think I'm being judged down. I don't ever think I'm being judged up.
Well, some people do... pay a lot of attention to what's going on, and some people seem to be oblivious. That's part of different kinds of personalities.
I notice that, you know, when you travel a lot, you go to another country and you watch people and you do what they do. And I'm always surprised when people don't do that. You know, like when people would come to visit me in France or whatever, and they would walk into a store with a drink in their hand. Like, do you not notice that no one has a drink in their hand in the store?
Well, but French people might walk into a store with a dog. You can't do that mm-hmm. in this country. So there are just different customs in different places.
That's true.
And they'd be smoking as well when they're not allowed. Well, that's a whole other thing. We'll come back to David Sedaris in just a moment. He is, as I'm sure you know, a regular contributor to The New Yorker, to BBC Radio 4. He is often on This American Life, and he's written – how many bestsellers have you written by now?
Oh, golly. I think one of them was – I don't think Barrel Fever was ever on the bestseller list, but I think that the others were. It sounds so strange for me to be saying that. I never dreamt that that would happen.
Well, we'll talk about that as well after we take a little break. The latest bestseller is Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. It's published by Little Brown. We're back with David Sedaris. His latest book, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, Essays, Etc., is published by Little Brown and immediately shot up to the top of the bestseller list. That has to be heartening. When you were when you were doing those menial jobs, did you ever envision that you'd become a success, or did you think you'd always be stuck in those kinds of things?
I think I braced myself pretty early on to that would be – those would be the sorts of jobs that I would have, because I'd just type with one finger and I never learned to drive a car. And I would come home at night and write. But that was I think I was fine with that. You know, it never occurred to me, like it never meant anything to me to sit at home all day. Like that was never my idea of success, was to not have a second job. But then when I moved to Europe, I didn't have a green card, and so that's when I started. I guess that's when I became a full-time moviegoer, really, because you know you're only going to sit at your desk for so long. So then I would go to the movies every afternoon.
Didn't watch television?
You know, I got to say, I was too lazy. You know, like it feels like work. It felt like work to watch television in France. And it would have been good for me to make myself watch television for an hour every day. And I didn't do it. And
Work because of the language. So you went to see American movies.
Yeah. Every day, every afternoon I would go to the movies. And it really, I mean, because there are... Gosh, umpteen movie theaters there, and there are a lot of little mom-pa movie theaters, and there's always a festival to every actor and every director. You know, there's Coen Brothers Festival going on, and then there's a John Wayne Film Festival, and there's a Preston Sturges Festival. And that's what bothers me when people make that Jerry Lewis comment about France. I've never seen... a Jerry Lewis festival. If anyone I've ever talked to in France, I say the word Jerry Lewis, they have no idea who I'm talking about. But Americans like to believe that the French worship Jerry Lewis.
Before you arrived.
Well, they gave him a medal, but heck, they give anyone a medal who sticks around for a while.
When you look back at the things that you wrote in your diary years ago, can you identify with that person, the person you were in 1977?
Sure. I mean, I think that I'm basically, because my diary is secret, I mean, because I've never handed it to anyone and I've never, so it's, I feel like it's the real me in there. And I think I'm unchanged in certain respects, right? Like I'm no less petty than I was back then. I'm no less, you could perform surgery in front of me and I wouldn't flinch, but proper, I suppose, like as proper as you can be with a mouth like mine, as I was back then. I mean, it's kind of touching to read and, you know, to read about when I first moved to New York, I would walk 30 blocks if I could save 10 cents a pound on chicken, right? And I would walk because I couldn't afford to take the subway. Or that's sort of touching to me now.
Now, are you willing to have people read your diaries after you die? Or are you going to put in your will, I want all of my papers destroyed?
Well, I would want them to... I mean, I always thought that I wanted the diaries destroyed. But they're pretty. They're nice objects. You know, the covers are nice, and there are pictures in them, and that's nice.
How many do you have now?
Gosh, 35 times 4. Because I do one for every season. So 35 times 4. But like I told Hugh, like if he's not a nosy person, but I said, if you ever read my diaries and you read something bad about yourself, keep reading because there's going to be something good on the next page. I guarantee you.
You're right about buying a house in West Sussex. What's that area like, and why did you decide to buy a house there?
We went to visit a friend there, and we have these friends in London, and they're a couple in their 80s, a man and a woman named Viv and Gretchen. So we went to visit them, and they lived in West Sussex in an area called the South Downs. And the Downs are these like massive chalk-speckled hills that run 100 miles through east and west Sussex. And we just fell in love with it. Just, it was my idea of beauty. So
different, like, than the countryside in the United States?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never seen countryside that looks like that in the United States. Because all it does is rain. Like, it's so green it makes your eyes ache. And we're 8 miles from the English Channel. But you know, like in the United States, usually when you get near the coast, the land flattens out and the trees become scrubby. It's not like that there. And we started looking at these houses, and the only other house we considered, because all the houses have names, right? So our house is like 500 years old, and it's called Swan Cottage. And the only other house we looked at was called Faggot Stacks. That was the name of it. And it was as old as our house.
Which means sticks of wood.
Yeah, actually. Yeah. But I was ready to buy it just as a mailing address, because you cannot go wrong with that name, can you? And so we bought this house, this farmhouse, and it was in pretty bad shape. So it's in better shape now. Hugh's good at stuff like that. And London has a 39% immigrant population, because I had to take a test called Life in the UK in order to get my green card. But in the country—
They actually ask those kinds of questions?
Mm-hmm. They ask questions like how much do senior citizens have to pay for eye exams? When did women first get the right to divorce their husbands? How old do you have to be to deliver milk in the United Kingdom?
Well, I'm sure that if they ask those questions to people who are born in England, they probably couldn't answer all of them.
Right. It's like here, people who take their test here. You know, people have this idea that all you have to do is marry somebody to get your papers, and it just does not work that way. It's exhausting. It's a lot of work to get your papers.
So anyway, you're getting back to the immigrant population.
Oh, so, but in the country, everybody's English, and it's completely different. Because before I ever went to England, people would talk about the class system there, and I didn't really see it in London, because when you're a foreigner, you just walk in the middle of that. You just don't. It's something that goes on between English people, but unless you're tuned into it, you just walk down the middle of it, and it doesn't affect you. But so it's really interesting being in the country and seeing to what extent that's really true.
Because people are open about their attitudes about.
No, I think that's part of the. Yeah, they're open about their, but you know, they're open about their attitudes, like with people who are in their class. Do you know what I mean? Like, so. But I think they're not open in a way that Americans are really open, like Australians. You can talk to I go to Australia a lot, and I sign books, and I say to someone, "How much money do you make a year?" They love telling me. I said, "How much did your house cost?" No problem whatsoever. And I think there's something really good about that openness. And Americans will do that too.
It seems to me that as an American in England, I went to school in England. I had a pass because I was a Yank.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really fit into any of the class preconceptions.
Right. No, I don't either.
If they'd known how poor I was, they probably would have probably refused to talk to me.
But where we live now, like somebody had their barn remodeled and they put the wrong doorknob on it. And there was a lot of talk about that doorknob. So it's that kind of a community. Right?
On the other hand, you say there's a lot of trash on the side of the roads and the woods there, something I wouldn't have expected in a fancy area.
It is heartbreaking to me. The roadsides are carpeted with rubbish, carpeted. And we live near this beautiful forest, and you know, you go to the forest and then someone's dumped a microwave into the forest, or someone's dumped like several bags of household garbage into the forest. And I spend hours every day picking up rubbish on the side of the road. Hours. And I'm not, and I don't get angry about it really. It's kind of a perfect sort of hobby slash activity for me. And Hugh does it too, but he doesn't. You know, he rides his bike to the village every morning, so he'll pick up stuff on the way, but he didn't go out of his way to do it, and I go out of my way to do it.
How does the level of litter compare to Normandy, where you used to live?
It's 0 to 60. I mean, there was no roadside rubbish. Well, there was a guy who was a elected politician who lived near us in Normandy, who threw everything out his car window. Everything went out the car window, and I would find his cigarette packs, and I knew that they were his. But in England, everybody doesn't do it, but one out of either three or four people readily admit to throwing rubbish out their car window.
My guest is David Sedaris. His latest book is Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. You've written in the past of some obsessive compulsive behaviors you had when you were growing up. Do you think that cleaning up all of that stuff is somehow related?
Definitely. You know, I mean, it's cleaning my house, except my house is clean, so I've moved out into the world at large. And I know that it's become obsessive behavior.
But you've talked about losing most of the OCD. Do you think it's just been changed as your life circumstances have changed?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think instead of like having to you know, get out of bed in the middle of the night and lick the light bulb in the refrigerator and to do things at exactly the same time, you know, just silly things, do them at the exact same time every day, I kind of made it work for me, right? So I write at the exact same time every day, so I can channel it towards something positive. And with I don't know, picking up rubbish, if I don't like to be left to my own thoughts for long periods of time, it's just not good. I just think about the same negative things over and over and over again. And so I don't know why I don't do that when I'm picking up rubbish, but I just don't. So it's a really good activity for me.
Well, were you worried that some of your tics would return when you gave up smoking?
I did. And then I did develop like a new thing, but I can forget about it for weeks on end. Now that you mentioned it, then it's going to come back to me. But it's kind of like I don't know how to describe it. It's kind of like leaning on a muscle until I'm lame. So I do that sometimes.
When you were traveling last year, your passport was stolen along with your computer. What did that mean for you when you try to return home to England?
Well, my green card was in my passport, so I got my passport stolen. Someone broke into this house. I was renting with Hugh and my sister in Hawaii, and someone broke in and stole my computer bag.
Now, it's a green card in England, too?
It's called Indefinite Leave to Remain, mm-hmm. And it was a sticker in my passport. So it's in the computer, right? It's in the computer that I have it, so push the button on the computer and give me another one. Well, it doesn't work that way. So you have to fill out all these papers, and then you have to send your passport in. And so I did that, and then they wrote back and said, you should hear back from us within 6 months. And I had a lecture tour lined up. I can't surrender my passport for 6 months. It was a nightmare. It was just a nightmare. And then someone in Hawaii found my computer bag, and my passport was in there. And like that, my nightmare was gone.
You were lucky.
So very lucky. But then ever since, you know, I wrote a story about it, but in the meantime, the British Home Office, the scandal erupted. You know, they're so far behind in cases, and so it's really been spotlighted there over the past few months. It's just scandalous how inept and backed up they are.
Well, would your story make it into the newspapers? Are you well-known in Great Britain as well?
I do things on the BBC, mm-hmm. on BBC Radio 4, and I've written things for The Guardian and for The Times of London, and so I have a little bit of a presence there. And I got to say, it feels really good to start over in another country and try to carve a little place out for yourself.
You return home regularly, and by touring, you probably see more of the United States than most of us do. Has living abroad changed the way you view America?
Yeah. I mean, because you probably knew that when you lived in England and went to school, you become the American, so you're the person people go to for answers, right? So something happens like the shooting in Connecticut, and people say, does your family have a gun? And what is up with you people and your guns? And so whatever the event is, I'm asked about it as if I'm a big authority. And I didn't come from a gun family. And it's interesting. I didn't think when I go to a show, I didn't think anyone in my audience would have a gun. So it's been really interesting to meet people who say, oh, yeah, I have a gun. You know, I keep it for protection under my bed. I just didn't think anyone would have one. So it's not like an overwhelming number of people. But that's been interesting, going across the country and asking people about guns.
Do you ask them when they're coming up to you, asking you to sign a book? Are you packing?
If you came up to me to get a book signed, I would say, does your father have a gun? Mm-hmm. Because you have a beard. And I used to have
a
theory that guys with beards had guns. But then I realized guys with beards have fathers who have guns. And
my father never had a gun.
Really? Well, you know, New York, I've been asking people all day, and it doesn't work out here. But there are states. But I think...
Well, there are states where the kids have guns.
Right. In Arizona, everyone seems to have a gun. So it's a pretty safe bet there that anyone with a beard, their dad's going to have a gun.
So you've traveled all over the world. You're right about going to China, for example. You've talked about going to Australia. Do you find that people are basically the same, or they really are different, or does it depend on whether the Second Amendment applies?
I mean, it's interesting going places for work. You know, if I'm going places for work, then it's completely different because, you know, I'm going to go and do a reading, and then I'm going to sign books, and so people are lined up in front of me with something I wrote in their hand. So it's a weird way to meet people. I'll take it. You know, if it's my only option, I'll take it. Audiences, like when I was in China, I did a reading, and then I thought, gosh, did they not know that I started? Because people were talking in a normal tone of voice. They didn't even lower their voices for the reading. And then I have a rule, like, you never stop for any reason, because a live confrontation is inherently more interesting than what's written on a page. But I stopped and I said, you people have to shut up. I said, I don't mean you have to lower your voice. You have to stop talking. That's really naughty what you're doing. You have to stop talking. And they just laughed, and then they started talking. it got me like 45 seconds of silence.
Just one more thing. Throughout this conversation, you've talked about, in effect, having low self-esteem, despite the fact that you've had this incredible success. You've written about your father calling you a big fat zero. Does it go back to that time? And can't you get past that?
I don't know. I think that self-esteem is overrated. You know, actually, I mean, I think this idea that everyone's got to have self-esteem and it will solve all their problems. That was my dad's mantra to me. You know what you are? A big fat zero. But it's what got me out of bed every morning.
It motivated you to do?
Yeah, it really did. And so I wouldn't have wanted any other dad than the one that I had. But, I mean, I think that's healthy, too, let's say you write a book and your book does well. Well, that doesn't mean it's a good book. You know, it might mean that I'm a lucky person. But I think it's ultimately better to think that way than to go around thinking you're so great.
Well, David Sedaris' latest book is Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls, Essays, Etc. And it's already a bestseller, but that's obviously simply because he's been very lucky, not because this book is any good. The book is published by Little Brown. David, it's a good book.
Oh,
it's,
I'm so lucky.
It's funny as always, and a lot of wonderful insights. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.